Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
When you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
It was an explosion that injured 36 and forced thousands of Superior residents to evacuate. Now, a federal report reveals Superior oil refinery officials were aware for years of issues with equipment believed to be responsible for the blast at the facility in 2018. Plus, it's the biggest concert event of the year in the Twin Ports, with almost 200 acts appearing at a club near you. We'll tell you all about the Homegrown Music Festival. Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
In heartbreak and pain at the Walmart.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
When you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
It was an explosion that injured 36 and forced thousands of Superior residents to evacuate. Now, a federal report reveals Superior oil refinery officials were aware for years of issues with equipment believed to be responsible for the blast at the facility in 2018. Plus, it's the biggest concert event of the year in the Twin Ports, with almost 200 acts appearing at a club near you. We'll tell you all about the Homegrown Music Festival. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. 4 years ago last week, an explosion at the Husky Energy oil refinery in Superior injured 36 workers and contractors and sent a large plume of black smoke into the sky that could be seen for miles. Many of the city's 27,000 residents evacuated, crowding the bridges and other routes out of town, amid fears that the highly toxic chemical hydrogen fluoride could leak from the plant. In an exclusive report by my colleague Danielle Kading of WPR News, documents from the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration show that Superior oil refinery officials knew for years about issues with equipment believed to be responsible for the explosion. That includes knowledge of erosion on a key piece of equipment 10 years before the accident. Here is Danielle Kading's report.
The Superior Oil Refinery has operated in the city since 1950. Now, construction is ongoing behind me, just a few miles from Lake Superior. The refinery's towers and tanks are still here, but there are cranes and contractors working on rebuilding the plant after an explosion 4 years ago. Most of the workers were on break when the explosion hit. Even so, 36 people reported injuries that range from spinal fractures to minor cuts and bruises. Attorney Kyle Finley represents 9 contractors who are suing the refinery for medical costs and lost wages.
The impact it had, the hard hats being blown off, people knocked off scaffolding. I mean, it's a very traumatic event.
That night, refinery manager Colin Shady told reporters that the blast took place as the facility was shutting down for maintenance.
Throughout 2013, we did a similar event where we shut the entire refinery down. We go inside every vessel and we check everything for mechanical integrity.
The U.S. Chemical Safety Board said a worn valve likely caused the blast by allowing air to flow backwards inside a unit that's important for producing gasoline. And an investigation by federal labor regulators found the refinery could have prevented the explosion if it had properly maintained critical equipment. WPR obtained more than 1,300 pages of documents from that investigation by the Occupational Health and Safety Administration. They reveal the refinery knew about problems with erosion on that key valve a decade before the explosion. OSHA found the worn valve had been repaired during the refinery's last shutdown in 2013, and the one before that had been rebuilt in 2008. Holes in the valve were found during both shutdowns, and refinery workers knew the valve could leak because of erosion. In the final hours before the blast, workers reported hearing 2 booms from inside a refinery control room. Documents show the plant's operators and supervisors didn't fully investigate what had caused them. Finley says evidence shows things were going wrong for a long time.
when you don't take the precautions, exactly what you think will happen, and that is an explosion.
OSHA found the refinery should have inspected the valve more frequently and changed it out sooner. And the agency found no documented inspections of repairs to that valve by the refinery during the last two shutdowns. Operator logs also showed the Warn valve was malfunctioning in the days leading up to the explosion. Plant managers had changed its shutdown procedure just a day before the incident and hadn't given operators adequate training. Jordan Barab served as OSHA's assistant deputy secretary during the Obama administration. He says it's not uncommon to see procedures and training that don't keep up with changes at refineries.
Rewriting procedures and retraining workers and all that kind of stuff is not something that directly leads to profit. It's easy to cut corners there.
Barab says it's important to have strong involvement from workers or unions to promote safety. WPR reached out to 9 contract companies on site that day and 4 local union representatives, but none agreed to speak publicly. Atticus Larson is a refinery electrician and member of the International Union of Operating Engineers Local 420. In late 2018, Larson said during a Chemical Safety Board meeting in Superior that no price can be put on safety.
Did people think safety was expensive before? Look what it costs us now. We need to start using the most up-to-date safety standards that have been in the industry for years. The most important thing, period, is for everyone to go home safely after every shift to their family.
Last year, Husky merged with Cenovus Energy in a roughly $5 billion deal. In an earnings call last week, the company said the $1.2 billion rebuild has the refinery on track to resume normal operations early next year. Alex Pourbaix is CEO and president of Cenovus Energy.
In terms of an update on the rebuild itself, we remain on schedule to restart by the end of the year. And we very much look forward to that day. With a nameplate capacity of 49,000 barrels per day, Superior will be an important addition to our heavy oil value chain as the first stop on the Enbridge mainline.
A Cenovus spokesperson said in a statement that the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment. That includes new slide valves. The lawsuit from contractors who were caught in the 2018 explosion is still ongoing.
That was my colleague Danielle Kading with a report on documents from the Occupational Safety and Health Administration showing that Superior Oil Refinery officials knew for years about issues with equipment believed to be responsible for the explosion at the facility in 2018. She joins me now. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So, first of all, OSHA doesn't normally make a document dump of this magnitude, both in terms of page count, you acquired 1,300 of them, and in the gravity of what those documents say. How difficult was it to get them?
Well, I believe that we first made the request following OSHA's conclusion of its investigation. So we submitted the request in early 2019. And then we had to adjust it because they came back and said it was overly broad. And so we resubmitted that. And then, as you know, a lot happened in the last couple of years. COVID hit. And so we received those documents roughly 2 years later, sometime last year.
Mm-hmm. You've been covering the explosion and its aftermath for 4 years now. Husky promised to rebuild and reopen the refinery not long after the accident. 3 years ago, in an earlier incarnation of this show, you spoke with Rob Simons, who was then Husky's chief operating officer before his acquisition last year by Cenovus Energy of Canada. Here's your conversation with him then.
Post the incident, there were a lot of questions we had to answer. And exactly how we were going to rebuild the refinery was one of those. We very early on decided we did want to rebuild. We wanted to stay in the Superior area. We wanted to continue to invest in this refinery. So then we had to look at, were we going to make major change to the refinery? Quickly got to a point to know we wanted to rebuild this refinery in essentially the same configuration that we had before, similar throughputs, taking out a few bottlenecks. Clearly one of the big questions that we had to answer because of the community's concern in it was the continued use of hydrogen fluoride. We heard that concern. We spent a lot of time talking with experts across the industry, visiting various plants, looking at alternatives that might be there, and certainly can go into details on those alternatives. Bottom line, in the end, we've decided to continue the use of hydrogen fluoride, but we are going to add some additional safety features. While the HF unit was not breached during the incident, and all of the safety systems worked as designed. There's an opportunity to put in some additional ones. We're going to take that. That's our proposal, which is in with the regulators now. We're in that permitting process, and in the end, we're that is our proposal, though, to do that. Would you like me to go into the detail on those enhancements?
Please do.
Okay, so the enhancements that we're adding, the first one is a rapid transfer system. So what that allows is to take all of the hydrocarbons and the acid out of the HF unit and quickly, that's within 10 minutes, dump it into a dedicated tank that can be protected. So that if any incident is occurring in the refinery, that choice can be made instantly. That's a thing that some of the more modern installations have. Remind ourselves that we've been operating HF here for almost 60 years. And so this was an opportunity to upgrade that. One of the others is a laser detection system. So this is a way to look for leaks at a very small level. We already have installed a temporary laser detection system because the HF is still on site, as you know. That laser detection system will then allow us to see leaks and automatically trigger our water deluge system if we choose to do that. And the third piece that we've increased, we are increasing the water deluge. Hydrogen fluoride is very, very soluble in water. So the best defense against a leak is to have a lot of water. It dissolves it very quickly. So we're going to increase the size of the water spray system, take it over some of the areas it doesn't currently cover. And we think those three major components will allow us. Oh, sorry, I had one other. We're adding some paint. So there's a special paint that changes color when exposed to hydrogen fluoride. So we're using that paint on the valves and on the flanges where there might be a very small leak so that we can see it with that camera system. And again, we would use the deluge system to knock any cloud down. We also are installing some additional valves so that we isolate smaller pieces of the system so that if there's a leak in a small part of it, you don't expose it to many others. So we think all of those additional safety features will enhance what is already a safe system.
Okay. And I want to get to the reasons why you decided to stay with that and why the other options weren't viable. But first off, since you are keeping hydrogen fluoride, you know, in the Chemical Safety Board said that the tank holding hydrogen fluoride that day was about 150 feet away from where the explosion occurred. And there was debris that punctured the asphalt tank, which spilled, causing the fires. So will the location of the tank change at all to minimize the impact of a spill as well, or of a release?
No. We're not looking to move the, where the unit is. However, in order to give additional protection against a shrapnel strike, which indeed what we saw, we're going to look for some engineered fencing that will be able to catch debris as it comes towards it. Again, it's never 100% because a piece can always come around or come through, but we are going to engineer a physical barrier as well. Then we believe that with the laser detection, if you did have a break, the laser detection system would very quickly see that, allowing you to turn on the deluge very quickly, because the key is to turn on those deluge systems as soon as you can. And we're talking about here within sort of 10 or 15, 20 seconds, and then reduce the amount. But yes, we will have a physical barrier engineered as well as the other barriers that we've talked about.
Okay, so the idea is that the risk would be minimized through the water curtains or water cannons surrounding that, and that once a leak or a release may occur, then that additional chemical would be moved from into another tank nearby once that's detected. So it would be less than could possibly be released.
Yes, I think the way to think about it is if we have not had a release, but we're concerned one may occur, we can immediately decide to move all of it out of the system. If the system was running and we had an explosion that created that shrapnel and it hit it, we would be isolating everything that we had and using the deluge system to knock down any that came out. Our goal is never to have any hydrogen fluoride released, which is why we have a very extensive maintenance system. We have a very extensive system, and now the idea to put some physical barriers in front of that because of this potential hazard of shrapnel is going to be added.
And that was Robert Simons, then Husky's chief operating officer before his acquisition in 2021 by Cenovus Energy of Canada, speaking in 2019 with my colleague Danielle Kading. So, Danny, is there an update to that? And did Cenovus respond specifically to the findings in the OSHA documents? I want to read a line from the OSHA report, which says, quote, according to interviews and records, holes were found in the spent slide valve on two past turnarounds, April 2008 and April 2013, and those interviewed indicated that they were aware that this valve could leak because of catalyst erosion on the leading edge of the valve gate and seat ring, close quote. A bit of technical jargon, as you would expect from investigators, but very germane to the essence of the incident.
Well, we did ask Cenovus to comment on how they have been addressing the abatement recommendations that OSHA made as part of its investigation. And we reached out to Cenovus for an interview based on what the documents showed. We asked to speak with them about the spent catalyst slide valve that investigators cited as the likely cause of the explosion. And they said that no one was available to speak with us, but they sent along a statement saying that the refinery is taking steps consistent with OSHA's recommendations to verify the condition and operability of equipment. They said that the refinery is being rebuilt with state-of-the-art equipment, and that includes new state-of-the-art slide valves. That also includes new crude and fluid catalytic cracking units that is important for producing gasoline, and where that spent catalyst slide valve was located that failed. And the company has said that it's resolved all of OSHA's recommended abatement actions and that they've updated their process hazard reviews for new and unaffected areas of the refinery. And basically, OSHA's inspection team found that none of those reviews had addressed erosion of the slide valve or the potential for air to get into that system during startups or shutdowns prior to the explosion. And so, you know, OSHA has said that they've discussed their concerns with the refinery during the rebuilding process and that they reserve the right to conduct any follow-up inspections.
All right. Well, we'll remain open and invite Cenovus to, again, respond as things continue to develop. A very informative report, Danny. You'll come back and join us for the rest of the news later in the show?
Of course.
Okay. We'll see you then. Coming up, it's happy homegrown time.
Violent sweep of the past leaves no trace of the real. Boxes of grief and regret spill over a waste like time.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So imagine your birthday is coming up. Maybe it's the big 3-0 or 4-0, and you know a few musicians who might want an excuse to play at a party. Before you know it, five bands have signed on, and it turns out to be something taking on a life of its own. That's the story behind Homegrown, the Twin Ports week-long festival that's been happening every year since the 30th birthday of Duluth band member and pirate radio host at the time, Scott Lunt, in 1998. It's a particular showcase for local talent, but it may be best known for his chicken logo, which, well, I'm getting ahead of the story. To better tell it, we're joined by Homegrown's executive director, Melissa Ginger. Welcome to Simply Superior, Melissa.
Thank you.
So you're Homegrown's full-time executive director, and a lot of listeners may not be aware that putting on a week-long festival is a year-long affair. How long has it been a full-time job?
Well, the festival originally obviously was run by Scott Lunt, and then through the years it evolved into growing a steering committee. It used to be a for-profit festival. Don Ness, who was a former mayor of ours, he ran the festival for a year as well, and he made it the nonprofit that it is. And then as it was starting to get larger, Walt Dizzo, who's known for DJing around the area.
A Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, yes.
Absolutely. And he took the festival to a new level, both with growth and with public outreach. And when he came on as director, he brought me on as his volunteer coordinator. When Walt retired, I then took over and I'm currently the longest running director of the festival. We've had several musicians that have been on the steering committee, on the board. Paul Conley, who's a local artist in town, he directed the festival. Tim and Brad Nelson had the festival for a while. And then, yeah, Don Ness, really, he has a brother, obviously, that plays in the local music scene and has been a huge ambassador for local music in the community in general.
That would be Jamie.
Jamie Ness, yep. And then, yeah, it's just become this large community feel that definitely needs a lot of moving parts. And then I would say over the last 10 years, we've really had to lean on the steering committee and the board members for organization. And I would say since about 2012, when Walt took over as director, subcommittees were growing. So we were really trying to piece out different areas of the festival that different people could be delegated to and then, you know, run with it. And really that would alleviate some of that stress for the director to focus on other public outreach.
Mm-hmm. You're making me feel like the only person in town who's not been involved in this. So I'm beginning to feel guilty. What was I supposed to be doing, right? Is it a full-time job for the full year? You know, there's some festivals like First Night in Boston is their New Year's thing, but it starts the day after New Year's. And, of course, Grandma's is a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. As far as a full-time job, everybody involved in Homegrown with the planning piece from the volunteers, the performers, the steering committee, the board of directors, myself, the venues, you know, the whole community. It is a year-long planning. And with that, it's that focus of having Homegrown happen year-round. That's the trick and the balance, you know, trying to take this wonderful thing that packs the venues and packs the streets with all this excitement, but really showing the artists throughout the year that it's still a need. We want to see full venues or at least, you know, attendance at all of these different shows and performances throughout the year. That's probably the number one feedback for a wish list from our local performers is that they really wish that they would see the public, you know, coming out to support more often than what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we have to get the chicken out there more and so people can identify it. Right, yes. We're going to get to that chicken in a bit.
But sure.
We're speaking with Melissa Ginger. She's the executive director of the Duluth, and I should say Twin Ports, right? Homegrown Music Festival, which has been going on this week and continues throughout the weekend.
Yes, we do include the Twin Ports. The name that we have more recently adapted to is the Homegrown Music Festival because we used to be Duluth Homegrown Music Festival. Mm-hmm. But obviously with our neighboring city over the bridge and the support there, we have kind of dropped the Duluth part and we call it Homegrown Music Festival. And then the music that we include is from the Twin Ports and the Iron Range, kind of the Arrowhead region. We have reached out to other areas like Minneapolis to reinvite or allow applications from people that had a heavy presence here in the music scene and bands who might have, you know, part residency in the Twin Cities and part up here.
Mm-hmm. And I assume other points beyond that, too. So
yes.
Because we do send people out all over the place. So
mm-hmm.
How many acts are there?
There are about 194 acts this year.
Whoa.
Yes, so it's grown quite a bit.
No wonder it's a full-time job, yes.
It is. For my planning, the actual festival planning, though, I would say we usually take that month off afterwards, month to month and a half, to kind of relax and get that work-life balance back on track. And then we start planning right away because we have to get, you know, the ad sales ready for the field guide, and we have to figure out which venues and which days and get permits for the city because we have fire spinners and parks that we use for part of the programming. So there is a lot of planning that happens throughout the year, but we start to really get heavy once October, November starts, because that's when we really start to form the application for the performers. We have to open band application process. Then we have to listen to and view all of the applications and actually take a full day to select and then send everything out. So it's like this ongoing thing. And then Paul Lundgren runs our field guide with mm-hmm. the layout assistance of Kim Wickman. And those two start their planning and like the page count and like how many ad sales we have available. And if we have to add pages and things like that, we start seeking out the local artists for the t-shirt and the cover art usually around late, I would say October, November, December, right in there, so that they have time to come up with the artwork in time for production.
This year you have another one of our UWS alums, Emily Koch, did a poster, I understand?
She did this year's field guide cover.
Mm-hmm.
So we had seen her art at several different events throughout town. I know the Embassy, this really cool art venue that hosts a lot of art parties and projections and things. She's part of that collective down there. And from catching her show, catching her artwork all over the city on different things, I've purchased some myself. She was selected by the steering committee to be this year's cover artist for the Homegrown Field Guide. And when we spoke with her, that was one of her lifelong dreams to be featured.
Wow. I should say not just University of Wisconsin-Superior alum, but of our own Wisconsin Public Radio station, KUWS. And we are very proud of her. You know, as you describe how large this is, I am no longer going to tolerate anybody saying there's nothing to do around here, because as soon as you're
totally
done, there's Grandma's, then there's Bayfield Apple Fest, then there's the Berkey Binder. I'm skipping a couple million things in the fall. So, all right, no more of that. What have been some of the highlights this week and what's still to come? Is there one particular band perhaps you can, well, a couple that you might want to point out?
Sure, absolutely. So for this past opening Sunday, we kicked off with the Children's Music Showcase. The cool thing about that particular event was it was free for the entire community. So we do a lot of advertising and push out for that, because everything from balloon art to face painting, it's good for everybody, and parents don't have to worry, do I have enough money to pay for the face painting? And it's a, you know, kid-friendly environment. It took place at the Duluth Public Library and the Depot's Railroad Museum. But as far as acts that blew me away, Afro Geode and the Gemstones, they were at the mayoral proclamation at Hoops Brewing, along with Stardust Collective, and both acts equally brought all the feels. We had goosebumps. Everyone's eyes were glued to both performances. I got teary-eyed many times.
I can imagine you would. Afro Geode has been on the show at least a couple of times, and since I know this performance wasn't recorded, let's hear something she shared with us in the past. This is Unprotected Woman.
With resilience and grace. piggy bank for sorrow and a pack your white chicks borrow. That's right, I said borrow, because they never want to pay. Oh, space, say space, puts oppression in its place. Runs a race, fast pace, but never does she play. Black women in America are disproportionately subject to disrespect, and black women have come to expect that it's themselves they must protect. Black women are performing cultural taxation, commodified by appropriation, and the first chosen for emotional exploitation. Black women. Black queens.
And that was Unprotected Woman by Afril Geode, who, as Afril Geode and the Gemstones, were the kickoff group at the mayoral proclamation ceremony for Homegrown 2022 at Hoops Brewery in Duluth on Sunday. We're speaking with Melissa Ginger, the executive director of Homegrown. You also had a poetry showcase, and it, like Afril Geode, included people who've been on the show before. Jason Ewan, Crystal Defleson, Gary Bohauer. We've never had Rocky Makes Room on. He's always fun.
Absolutely.
So again, because the poetry showcase wasn't recorded, we called up Rocky and asked him to share a poem. And in fact, he shared what he wrote specifically for the occasion.
Hey, hey.
Hey, back at you, Rocky. It's Robin Washington. You were part of the Homegrown Poetry Showcase. What poem did you showcase?
Well, each reader was limited to 3 minutes, so that was kind of a challenge of its own. So I did what the best I could with what I have in the time frame, and I wrote just one long poem. There was a lot of poets that maybe read 2 or 3 poems in that time, but I just made one long poem.
Well, are you ready to share it with us?
I am. And this is called Midakuye Oyasin. A Lakota word for the concept that we are all related. And it's springtime and the rains have come. It's time to plant those seeds, and I'm here to plant one way deep inside your heart. And may your voice be like a thunder and lightning that sparks the growth of fresh roots through your veins. And may you grow to a beautiful medicine flower, your spirit reflecting in the sky as stars. Midakuye Oyasin. We use this phrase after talking about such sacredness, such as even in food or in life and death, the relatedness of the universe glittering in our eyes, and the prayer in its own phrase alone. We are all related. We are all relatives. From the beginning, as our earth became our mother, we've called the sun our father. And the internal voice singing to us that everything is alive, has a spirit, has a spark of electricity, has a voice, is then considered sacred. With the gift of life and death, makes us our relative. So then this must be true of the water. We need it to live and we can die from it. So it has electric energy within it and a spirit and a voice. We've all heard some whispers from our beautiful Lake Superior, the flows of creeks, the sound of rain. So it is our relative, air, rocks, fire, plants, and all the animals, our own Mother Earth. You have a spirit. You have a spark within. You are sacred. You have a place here. You have the ability to make life and make death. And so I call you my relative. The energy right here is sacred. What if we all realized that we are all related? What if we all treated and respected that great concept of what is sacred? We would probably have so many disparities, maybe no hunger, no homelessness, no addiction, maybe even this thing of a monster called racism. Let us be reminded of who we are, you and I, tonight and forever on. Let us be relative. Thus, I've learned to self-heal from this concept, how to carry and let go of grief. I've learned that being in nature, especially alone, that nature will try to heal you. And if you talk to it, throw your voice in the universe, you will realize that the presence of the spirit of your past relatives are still around you, waiting for your voice, ready to help us. If this has been done for thousands and thousands of years, then it must be true. So call your name out to the universe when you're feeling sad or hurt, or just when you think you are all alone. The electricity in your voice will carry through the sacred alive air, and your spirit that left you for whatever reasons will come back to you. Your sacred self will be whole again, and you will be healed. A little medicine flower growing along this sacred lake. And the universe has a way of leading us to where we need to be at this very moment. Mitakoye Oyasin.
That was great. You did put your 3 minutes to good use.
Yes, it was very challenging. And I think during these times, for some reason, I'm having these feelings of people regathering again. And when we do that, it's just a good thing to be reminded of where we are in our place.
You know, as you mentioned that, I'm wondering, what was the gathering like for the poetry? Everybody knows Homegrown is, you know, the music fest, but poetry, what was that like?
Oh, it was beautiful because everybody's poems were just so good. And just to know that there were so many people that shared the same passion and feeling in their work, and it's really good energy, and I really just thrive on that. You know, that's how it was. It was great. Every poet there put their heart into it, and it was just beautiful. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You're quite welcome. And we are back with Melissa Ginger. She is the executive director of the Homegrown Music Festival. It's been going on this week and continues throughout the weekend. Before I go any further, tell us how we can attend, what's coming up.
Sure. So you can go to the website, www.duluthhomegrown.org. If you're out and about in the local community, we have our Homegrown Field Guide out there at several of the venues. And if you're not able to scoop one of those up because they are going fast, we do have QR codes up at different areas where you can scan that code and it'll pull up our current schedule. A lot of local venues are participating that are shared restaurants and music venues, so you can even get a bite to eat while you're there catching the music. Duluth Cider made a new cider this year called Hen House in honor of Homegrown, so you can even catch something fun like that.
Mm-hmm. COVID precautions, how are things working in that regard?
We are letting everybody know, we put it in the field guide to just be aware and be prepared for what the venue specifics are on a day-to-day basis, because we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, we're optimistic, but we're letting the venues make the shots there as they should based on size and everything else. And so far, we haven't had any complaints.
Okay. Well, one thing I know you got no complaints about whatsoever is the chicken. So, by the way, does the chicken have a name?
Yeah, we call the chicken, capitalized. way back in the day, Scott Lunt had some baby chicks at the what we call the Chicken Shack, which is our headquarters. And the original chicken on the original banner of Homegrown was more of a clip art chicken. It wasn't the official chicken that became our trademark logo. That was created by local artist Chris Monroe. And I think it sums everything up. You know, you look at that chicken and it looks like it's had a week, but a positive, fun party week.
Well, local artists certainly made good on the national scene, Chris Monroe. So once again, information is available at duluthhomegrown.org or in the Homegrown Field Guide, if you can get your hands on one, or borrow one from a friend. I'm going to say practically every club in the area is participating, and rather than put you on the spot to play favorites, Melissa, I've asked your predecessor, WPR's own Walt Dizzo, for an act he'd like to highlight. He chose Anne Catherine, who's playing at 11:30 tonight at the Rex in the Fickers Complex in Duluth, and who we will let take us out with her song, Folded. Melissa Ginger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Happy Homegrown.
Violent sweep of the past leaves no trace of the real. Boxes of grief and regrets spill over a wasteland time. But
I've got time. Now you, we've a rhythm and rhyme. Yeah, we've a stuck like glue. But it hit me like you was a fine ton brick. Blindsided, folded, and left for good. I had my turn on this crazy merry-go-ride. You played your cards mighty close to your chest. I'm reading between the lines, you fill in the rest. A make-believer turned deceiver, leaving behind what was true. You set your course with no disgorge, like a thief in the night. But I've got time. Now you, we've a rhythm and rhyme. Yeah, we've a stuck like glue.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined again by Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Hi again, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
And Rick Lovers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So, Rick, it's getting close to the summer driving season, but you might go out to your car and find it's not there. What's going on in the area?
Yeah, apparently the number of vehicles stolen in the city of Duluth spiked last year, jumping nearly 43% from pre-pandemic levels. Altogether, 303 vehicles went missing. The vast majority, however, were recovered within 5 days or less, according to the Duluth Police Department. That's not to say all those vehicles were in great shape. When they were recovered, the police said that they were found repainted, and the interiors were often trashed or littered with hypodermic needles in some cases. Now, Duluth appears to have a bigger problem with vehicle thefts than would be expected for a city of its size. According to the latest stats available from the FBI, they show that the per capita rate of vehicle thefts in metropolitan areas nationally was about 235 vehicles per 100,000 inhabitants. That was from 2020. If you put Duluth into those norms, you'd expect to see about 203 vehicle thefts annually, but the 2021 numbers exceeded that mark by nearly 50%. Duluth police say that many of the thefts could probably be chalked up as joyriding. Vehicles are most often taken when they're left running or when the driver has left a key or a key fob behind. The recovery rate for the stolen vehicles has been hovering around high 80% to lower 90% range. Police say that the vehicle thefts can be difficult to prosecute, particularly when the stolen property is abandoned. Police have had success bringing charges against responsible parties, sometimes as a result of video surveillance or when an individual attempts to flee a missing vehicle. The good news here is that unlike the Twin Cities, Duluth has not seen any recent carjacking activity to date, according to the Duluth Police.
We'll be thankful for that, but watch your keys. And assuming you do have your car, you might want to drive out to a lake, but even though it's May, it may not be what you hope for.
Yes, spring 2022 could go down as one of the later ice outs for far northern Minnesota lakes, according to the Minnesota DNR. And that may mean some lakes won't be ice-free in time for the May 14 Minnesota fishing opener. All northern Minnesota lakes have blown past their average ice out dates, in some cases a week or more behind their long-term average, as a frigid winter and cold spring have maintained lake ice far longer than usual. As of Wednesday morning, with about 10 days to go before the fishing opener, not a single lake north of Minnesota Highway 200 was reportedly ice-free. So the good news, however, is that last weekend's rain, coupled with a forecast of plenty of sunshine and warmer temperatures, is helping free up lakes with their ice. The consensus is that most lakes south of U.S. Highway 2 in Minnesota will be ice-free by May 14, while some lakes in the north may not. So anglers who are heading north should call ahead to bait shops, resorts, and lake residents to make sure their destination lake is open.
All right. Well, whether there's ice on the lakes or not, the smelt are jumping, and in Duluth, they're walking down the street.
Yes, the quintessential only in Duluth happening. The smelt parade is returning to the lake walk this Sunday after a nearly two-year hiatus due to the pandemic. When the smelt start running, the wacky parade takes place on the lake walk, featuring oversized puppets, a smelt king and a smelt queen. And there's stilts and music and people parading to Zeitgeist where they sit down to eat fried smelt. This year marks the 10th anniversary of the inaugural smelt parade. It's timed to the spring spawning run of the small silvery fish. The smelt run is a Northland tradition dating back to the middle of the 20th century, when smelt, officially native to the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans, were first discovered in Lake Superior after being accidentally introduced via Lake Michigan. This year's smelt parade will begin Sunday at 3:30 p.m. With a gathering and performance on the lawn in front of the Lake Superior Maritime Visitor Center. The second line parade will then proceed eastward along the lake walk, and Zeitgeist Cafe will once again host the smelt fry and dance at 5 p.m.
All right. Well, Danny, if those smelt want to venture to the Wisconsin side, they might be able to jump on a cruise ship.
Yeah, that's right. The city of Bayfield will now be a tourist destination for Viking Cruises, which is a cruise line that's based in Switzerland. And KBJR TV reported this week that those cruises are set to begin at the end of this month and go through this summer. And each ship that visits the city will be stopping for about a day before heading to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so the city and its Harbor Commission have been working to come up with a security plan, and they've been working with the U.S. Coast Guard. And those plans include a new screening station for visitors that will be funded in part with a $95,000 in funding from Viking to help pay for it. The cruise ships are going to anchor out in Lake Superior, and then smaller boats will shuttle people to the mainland so they can be screened when they come on shore. And the ships will visit the city on Tuesdays throughout the summer. And as you may or may not know, Viking Cruises also has stops in Milwaukee, and they recently announced that their Viking River Cruises will have voyages up and down the Mississippi River, and that will include stops in La Crosse as well.
Well, back in Superior, on a more serious and healthful note, there's an initiative to improve mental health services.
Yeah, Superior Mayor Jim Payne proposed a new initiative this week that's aimed at expanding those mental health services. And the city has a roughly $50,000 grant that it's looking to provide to the Encouragement Clinic in Superior, which is one mental health provider in the city. And the clinic has been trying to address issues with providing access to Medicaid patients in Wisconsin, because Northern Wisconsin and Superior have struggled to maintain providers that offer those services to those patients because the state's reimbursement rate for providing care is much lower than neighboring Minnesota. And so sometimes they'll lose providers who decide to provide their services across the border in neighboring Duluth. And so this clinic is trying to provide services to a mix of patients who have private insurance and then those that have the state-funded Medicaid Medicaid to be able to offer those services. And this grant would pay for a provider at the clinic that would offer services to uninsured and undiagnosed kids or young people. And this is kind of tied to the Superior School District because they've cited increasing issues with mental health and more behaviors among students, like an uptick in illegal behavior and kids missing school during the pandemic. And so Mayor Payne says the idea is that these students could receive group therapy through that clinic and use a combination of peer support and professional services to help them and those who are struggling. And so the grant will cover about a year of services, but it still has to be approved by the City Council at its next meeting.
All right. We've been speaking with Danielle Cady, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read about all these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music from Homegrown, the more rockin' side, if you will. Here's Ryan Van Sluten and Supertex with Doesn't Change a Thing. Stay safe, everyone.